if we want to wait, we'll go ahead and start, and I'm sure that more guys will trickle in. Welcome to everybody on the internet, our internet brethren, we should call them, right? And kind of start our own little church here. We are studying Isaiah chapter 6. It's for Epiphany 5, and the assigned reading is 6, 1 through 8, and then they have in parentheses 9 through 13. I don't know what those parentheses mean, except that you can read them if you want. But actually, that second part of the chapter is a very important part, of the whole thing. And of course, Isaiah 6 is a tremendously significant and important passage in the book of Isaiah, and indeed the Bible as a whole. One of the first questions that comes up in regard to it is, why is it placed where it is? Why isn't, if we're talking about the call and commissioning of Isaiah as this chapter is normally labeled, why isn't it the first chapter? And of course, as always, scholars have many different answers. The one I like, though, is that it's significantly placed there as, first of all, a conclusion to what has preceded it, but also as an introduction which follows it. The first five chapters, specifically chapter 5, talk in terms of Israel having a serious problem. On the one hand, the material, especially in chapters 2 through 4, say that Israel is going to be the holy people of God, and that the nations of the world are going to stream to it and to Jerusalem. On the other hand, chapter 5 emphasizes the fact that they're very sinful people. So there's a very serious problem there. Well, specifically the call of Isaiah, the first 8 verses, can be seen as a solution to that problem, especially in the very famous passage in which Isaiah's tongue is cleansed. Remember, he also puts himself with the other people. He has unclean lips, and he dwells in the midst of people with unclean lips. And so as the story goes on, as you can see, as Isaiah is cleansed, the implication is that there is cleansing or atonement for the people as well. So it kind of forms a conclusion to that section of Isaiah. Verses 9 through 13 then, though, remember, has that rather difficult passage, and I'm sure it would be difficult for you if God calls you and then tells you you're going to preach a message that's going to make everyone reject or harden people. Of course, that's quoted a couple times in the New Testament too in regard to the parables. And it forms kind of an introduction, especially to chapter 7, because you can already see that hardening starting in King Ahaz, when he rejects Isaiah's advice to be still and trust God, finally kind of leads Israel down that path to their final destruction, at the hands of Babylon. So it is in place there for literary reasons. So the first part of the chapter as a conclusion, the second part of the chapter is kind of an introduction. So let's turn to Isaiah 6 and get into it, because there's a lot for us to look at here. Verse 1 then of chapter 6, Bishnat mot hamelech Uzziyahu va'ereh et Adonai yoshev al kisei ram venissa. In the year of the death of the king Uzziah. Notice that construct chain there. Isaiah dates this vision, and I think he does for very significant reasons. Uzziah was a king who had a very long and successful reign. He reigned from like 792 to 740 BC. And during that time, Judah prospered. He had a lot of building projects. He built up the army. He increased their borders. So now all of a sudden, the king is dead. And when the king dies, of course, that always kind of precipitates a crisis among the people. You see, God's people now, quotes, are without a king. Who's going to be the king? And so here, rather significantly, I think, as the earthly king dies, Isaiah gets a glimpse of who is really the king of kings here. Notice that the verse begins with a temporal clause. Most normally in narrative, you will see a vayehi before that, remember. But you don't have to have that, so you just translate that in the year of the death of King Uzziah. And then, remember, a temporal clause is normally continued or connected with a vav. Juan calls that a vav of apodosis, or a connecting vav, which you don't really even need to translate. So simply, in the year of the death of King Uzziah, I saw et Adonai, the Lord, or God, NIV translate that as sovereign, sitting on a throne. Adonai, notice the gamats under the nun. The form of that word is used only to refer to the divinity, to God. When you have the word Adon with just a nun ending, it can be either God or an earthly king. When you have the first singular suffix Adoni, it can refer to Lord with a big or small L as well. But here Adonai is the one used for God. So he saw God sitting on his throne, then Ram Venisa, both participles, Ram from the root room, a call participle, to be high. All right. Participles have an adjectival or verbal function depending on the context. So here it's an adjective. And then Venisa from Nasa, it's a Nifal participle. So high and lifted up. And if you will notice, the Masoretes under Yoshev, you see that little dash mark there? And then under Kisei, the other dash, that's called a Merika and a Tifka. And it means that the Masoretes want you to separate Yoshev al Kisei from Ram Venisa. They want you to read it not that the throne is high and lifted up, but that Adonai is high and lifted up. So it is as if you put a comma after the Kisei. And it's significant because when these words Ram Venisa are used in Isaiah, they refer always to a person. Specifically in Isaiah 52 verse 13, they refer to the servant. It is the servant who is high and lifted up. And so you see, I think there's a connection to be made there. Okay, Veshulav Meleim et ha Hekal. A shul is a train or skirt, so his skirts, and notice the vision of Isaiah never gets higher than that. Kind of interesting. His skirts, Meleim, were filling the temple. Meleim is a participle, call participle from male. Remember, when you have stative participles, they are formed with a gamatz and a seire in the singular. This is a plural, Meleim. So, like yare, the participle would be yereim, same thing. Were filling the temple, and notice that the participle gets its tense from the main verb. So that notice that the vision is in the domain of the past. So that the participle expresses durative or repetitive action. Here it's durative. They were filling ha-hekal, the temple. The word hekal also means palace. It's used many times to refer to the royal residency. Here, of course, God dwells in the temple. That's his royal residence. And so hekal is also used for either temple or palace. Okay, verse 2. Seraphim omdim mima'alo, sheish kenafim, sheish kenafim le'echad. Seraphim, from the root saraf, which means to burn or to cauterize. Remember, this is the word that is associated with serpents in that story in Numbers, when God sent those poisonous serpents to bite the people, children of Israel. And so a lot of people think that the word is referring to figures that look like dragons or serpents in some way. It's possible, but the root meaning is saraf, and so it's just as likely that it simply means some kinds of fiery figures. Okay. So anyway, seraphim omdim, again, participle, were standing, mima'alo. Remember, Hebrew often puts a lot of prepositions together, kind of piles them up to get the reference as exact as possible. So literally, it's from above in respect to him. Okay? So above him. And notice they were standing around, and I guess since they were standing, you see, in that sense, above, but not that they were on a different plane than he was necessarily. Okay, now you have the shesh kenafim. Kenafim, the dual, used as the plural, and it's repeated twice for emphasis. Remember, Hebrew shows emphasis by repetition. You have that in Isaiah, for example, Isaiah 40, nachmu, nachmu, comfort, comfort, and a lot of times in Isaiah. And really in narrative in general, repetition means emphasis. So six wings le'echad, to each one. Echad here in a distributive sense, to each one. Okay? Bishtaim yekaseh panav, u bishtaim yekaseh raglav. With two, now each one was covering. Notice that this is a PL from kasa, PL imperfect. All right? The imperfect is normally used, obviously, to express the future tense. But in the domain of the past, which is where we're in, what we're in because of the main clause, it refers to aspect only. So durative action here. It overlaps in meaning with the participle in this case. So with two wings, each one was covering his face, and with two wings, each one was covering his feet. Ubishtaim yet o faith. And with two, each one was flying. That's a polel from oof. Okay? Oof. Yeah, oh faith. And again, hollow verbs often form polels. Kum does the same thing, komein. All right, verse 3. Vekara ze el ze ve'amar. You have the vav plus perfect. Remember, normally that would be translated in narrative following an imperfect, and he will call. But again, remember, we're in the domain of the past. It's following these participles. And so vekara takes on often, really, in most cases, the character of the imperfect. And he was calling ze el ze, or this one was calling to that one. The one was calling to the other, ve'amar, and was saying, kadosh, 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 Yahweh Tzevaot, holy, 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 Lord of hosts. The thrice repeated kadosh. Of course, the church fathers see the reference to the Trinity there. But again, the repetition indicates also superlative. This guy is really holy, in other words. He is the Holy One. And remember, the Holy One of Israel becomes the theme word throughout the book of Isaiah. It's used 26 times in the book of Isaiah, and I think only 6 times in the rest of the Bible. 26 times is called the Holy One of Israel. And it's interesting, when you follow this theme through Isaiah, it's fascinating what happens to it. In the first half of the book, the Holy One of Israel is looked at as the one who is other. And it's used in context in which people mock him and refuse to believe in him, and in context in which he is angry at the people. In the second half of the book, the Holy One of Israel becomes the Redeemer. And especially when you get to chapter 40 and beyond, chapter 43, I believe, he's the Redeemer, so that the one who is other is the one who actually saves us. And so kadosh is a very significant word in this verse. And then he goes on, melo kol ha'aretz kevodo. That melo is a noun, of course, from malah, to fill. It means what fills, or the fullness. So it's literally, the fullness of all the earth is his glory. All right? Or what fills all the earth is his glory. Notice that the predicate precedes the subject. In most nominal clauses, it's subject then predicate. When it's switched around, the author wants to indicate emphasis. And it's very much in place here because, remember, King Uzziah had died. So what's going to happen to Israel? At the same time, the glory of Tiglath-Pileser III, who came to the throne in Assyria in 745, was rising. All right, so in a sense, there was a time of crisis for Israel. Tiglath seemed to have all the glory. What does God remind Isaiah of here? Don't worry, in a sense. God's glory fills all the earth. I think it's significant, too, how that word kavod is used through Isaiah. In the first 22 chapters, and especially in the latter chapters, 21, 22, the nations are described as having glory. But it's glory that's going to be destroyed. And so in chapter 10, for example, Assyria is described as a forest whose glory is going to be cut down. And then you go right into chapter 11 about the stump of Jesse. A branch will come out from him. And in verse 11 it says, his rest, menuchato, his rest will be kavod, will be glory. So that you get the sense already in Isaiah 11 that there's one glory that is finally going to dominate. It's not going to be the nations. So that in chapter 21 and 22, Moab's glory is going to be destroyed, Keter's glory is going to be destroyed, Assyria's glory is going to be destroyed. In the second half of the book then, God tells us that his glory is going to dwell in Jerusalem and on Zion and protect Zion. And so his glory fills the earth, but it dwells in a special way on Zion. And finally in chapter 60 through 66, we share in his glory. That's the emphasis over and over again. So a very significant word in Isaiah. Okay? Verse 4. Va yanuhu amot ha-sipim mikol ha-kore v'habayit yimale ashan. And shook the foundations of the thresholds. So I guess he wants to imitate. He was standing in the temple, perhaps in the doorway of the temple or whatever, and the whole thing was shaking, even the foundations. Mikol ha-kore, from the voice of the one crying. And the house, yimale, there's a nifal from mala, was filled or was being filled again with smoke. So that again you have that durative sense, was beginning to be filled with smoke, you could even have. Okay? Now, Isaiah realizes he's in big trouble. Verse 5. Va'omar oili ki nidmeti ki ish atame sefataim anoki. And he said, woe to me, because I am undone. Dama can mean to be like or to resemble. It can also mean to cease. I am ceased. I am undone. Ki ish, because a man. Now, tame is an adjective. A man unclean of lips I am. This is an epexegetical infinitive. Notice you have the adjective followed by a noun. All right. Same thing as stiff of neck I am. We'd say stiff-necked. A man unclean in respect to lips I am. And I think lips is used like a synecdoche here to refer to the whole person. And why would he use lips? Because he has just seen these seraphim echoing these great praises continually before God. And here he's standing here feeling his uncleanness and his sin. No way does his mouth always bring forth those praises. And so he feels his unworthiness and his sin very intensely here. And then he goes on to include himself in the rest of the people. Ubitokam teme sefataim anoki yoshev. And in the midst of a people unclean in lips I am dwelling. All right, again, notice that the predicates come first for emphasis, both emphasize the uncleanness. Ki et ha-melech Adonai tzevaot ra'u einav. And again, here, notice it's usually verb, subject, object. Here, the object is first for emphasis. Because the king, Yahweh tzevaot, my eyes have seen. You can't see the king, you can't see Yahweh and expect to live. And that is exactly what Isaiah is feeling here. Then a marvelous thing happens. Va ya'af elai echad min ha-seraphim ubeyado ritzpa. One from the seraphim flew to me, Eli, ubeyado ritzpa, and in his hand a burning coal. Be melkachaim lakach me'al ha-mizbeach. A burning coal with tongs he had taken from the altar, whether it's the altar of incense or the sacrificial altar, he doesn't indicate. But anyway, you could also translate that vav in a subordinating way, who had a burning coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. Vayaga al pi vayomer, Hinei naga ze'al sefateka. And he touched my mouth, and he said, look, this has touched your lips. Vesar avoneka vechatateka tekufar. And your iniquity, the vav plus the perfect indicates consecution or succession. Therefore, your iniquity will vanish, and your sin will be atoned. Okay, notice the chiasm there. It puts the avoneka and the chatateka together for emphasis. All of it's going to be gone. God is the one who atones. And notice, he atoned when Isaiah recognized his sinfulness. He recognized his sinfulness, there is atonement. Again, the implication, there is atonement for God's people if they will but turn to him in repentance. Okay, now, Vayashma et kol Adonai Omer, et mi ashlach umi yelek lanu, vaomar, hinani shalacheni. And I heard the voice of God saying, who will I send and who will go for us? And I said, here am I, shalacheni, send me. Imperative with first common suffix. Notice the response to forgiveness. I think it's a very powerful theme here. Isaiah is forgiven. He can't stand and see the Lord, and yet he does and he lives. And from that, the response of a joyful heart to go out and spread the word. We could continue with this, but I won't do that. Thank you very much.